Welcome, welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, more than perfectly today, we welcome the return of Terrence Ward, who is our great ally, whose splendid book, The Wahhabi Code, is the antidote that especially Americans may have an understanding of the toxic tyranny of Wahhabism and the liberating medicine of Sufism. Terrence Ward grew up in Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Egypt, then on to Berkeley, home base, cross-cultural consultant, pollinating agent, and agent of liberating cultural hijinks, we're going to say, at this time of dire beauty, so that we may feel our kinship with the beauty of Islam and the whole Middle East as well, syncretism abounding. So just to weave a little context of our convening right now, the sun is at 15 Gemini, whose image is, you know, people giving a rousing speech on behalf of the earth. And we go, right. And one of the things I want to bring up also was when I was in Syria, Darmer Musa was an early century Christian monastery, then reimagining, reconjuring itself before the terrible invasion of ISIS as a center for Christian and Islamic dedication to the earth. And we go, right, that's what we want, this global vision. So off we go. Well, you began, few Westerners know that for 1,000 years, up until 1924, Mecca was a center for Sufi ecstatic prayer, dance, music, and tolerant honoring of the divine in all beings. Let's dive in back in there.
Well, yeah, the real trauma that very few of us understand, but that virtually all Muslims are aware of, in 1924, the British gave the green light to the Saud leader, Abdulaziz, to invade Mecca. By green light, I mean they didn't offer to assist the dynasty, the Hashemite dynasty, that had been guardians of Mecca for 1,000 years. And in one fell swoop, they chose another family to rule that mystical and magical city. And in doing so, they traded in the equivalent of a very open, a very tolerant agent who welcomed all of those Sufi practitioners for a very ultra conservative, one would argue very fanatic, recent interpretation of Islam that were the Wahhabis. And immediately, the first thing they began doing, Caroline, is destroying all the Sufi shrines, erasing the past. And that has continued to this day. In fact, there are all, I had mentioned the other time we spoke that there's even debates within the Wahhabi community, should they destroy the tomb of Muhammad?
Right. And as you say, you know, there's Joni Mitchell, they paved over paradise and put up a parking lot. So it's very literal, isn't it? Because you say that, you know, the house of the prophet and Fatima and say more about that.
Well, you know, if you can imagine the house of his beloved daughter, so his only child, the only child of the prophet, her house, along with the house where he lived with his first wife, Khadija, these two houses have been destroyed. One is now a site of public toilets. The other one is the site of a parking lot. And you say to yourself, how is it conceivable? And I guess the biggest mask to unveil as a trickster is to realize these are not traditionalists or fundamentalists. These are actually modernists that are trying to erase history, very much like the pain that all of us have if we drive down into the town where we grew up in, and we drive in and we just see Walmarts and big shopping centers where the soul of the place has been removed. That kind of power, yes, we have in our small towns or the cities we came from, but imagine it being in a place as pregnant with history and meaning and pregnant with all of that spiritual dimension. To remove the soul in that manner is an act of sheer violence. And that is actually what this regime then exports. I mean, what you talked about in Syria, this beautiful center that was gathering Christian and Muslim thinkers and religious figures, the first place that ISIS went to was to attack shrines and attack centers like that.
And we want to honor so many beings. When I was outside Palmyra before the terribleness, there was a wonderful Bedouin who ran the Baghdad Cafe who was so charming and playful, and he's like, here we get married, but we'll be modern, I'll have the children anyway, very playful. And everywhere were these the fossils from the desert that he'd found, and really kind of little altars everywhere. And my friend Deborah Felmuth, our great ally in Syria, said, how did this happen? And he said, Majnun. Right.
Yes.
And that gave me this wonderful word, because people think it means many things, but the way the Bedouin explained it to me, it means crazy for the divine.
Yes.
There's many kinds of madness, and we want Majnun.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And this is the antidote. You were asking me before, what is that antidote that Sufi pragmatism, mysticism offers? And actually, let me just get rid of this phone for a second.
No, we're all backstage together.
So let me just share this poem of Hafez. It
explains
it all. It says, I have learned so much from God that I no longer call myself a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Jew. The truth has shared so much of itself with me that I can no longer call myself a man, a woman, an angel, or even pure soul. Love has befriended Hafez so completely, it has turned to ash and freed me of every concept and image my mind has ever known. Majnun. Absolutely, moved and transformed by this love of the divine. And that is the other face of Islam that very few Americans are aware of. But I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with that other side. And this is what has to be reclaimed. It has to be reclaimed by friends like ourselves. It has to be reclaimed also by reaching out and talking to other Muslim friends and encouraging them, letting them feel safe and free to speak about both what's happened and what are ways forward. In a climate of fear, people shut down. They get very frightened. They become they quiet. They go silent. And this is what I'm so excited, Caroline, that you've understood that this is really one of the ways to break that silence.
Right, and to form alliances. We have a lot of listeners in the Iranian Persian community in Los Angeles, and every time I do a show and often reference the beauty of Islam, they go, thank you so much, because we cannot speak. Right.
Right.
And so it does behoove us to be voices for our allies, because we're not under that terrible fear pressure and the money and the temptation of the Saudis, who gave millions to Uber and everything. And as we addressed last week's show, too, which is, for each one of us, just to check, if Saudi said, here's 5 million, if you... It's like, right. Well, it's a initiatory temptation. We go, no. And that's where the Sufis are so great. But it's our mutual buddy, Coleman Barks, who really was an agent who smuggled Rumi across borders and popularized it in a quirky way. And he's a wonderful ally of ours. He's a good old Southern boy. He doesn't actually know that much about Arab culture in the Middle East. He's in many ways innocent, right? But we think of, beautiful forces seek to cross borders, and they choose somebody and they go, this is a perfect smuggling, because nobody will suspect how radical Rumi is coming out of Coleman's mouth, because it's beautiful. But he's very reassuring. Nothing to worry about here. I'm not even going to mention Islam. Nor will I mention that Rumi was a great astrologer, which he was. I can't quite remember the exact, but he would say when fate and torment, meet in the sky, your only choice is to dance directly towards it. Right?
Yes.
Embrace the thing. And this so radical. And Yeah, so smuggling Rumi across borders, and for each one of us, it's a profound time right now, this new moon of cultural influence, to wonder, you know, what are we dedicated to being a voice for? Each person, by our affinity, you know, and in a quirky way, you know, we track our affinities. So, yes, growing up in Washington, D.C., for some mysterious reason, I always loved the call to prayer. Just as a little girl, I was like, ah, because it's full of such transcendent yearning. And, and I've heard women sing it, which is quite fabulous, right? Because we're mixing it all up and brewing things. But and then the music of the Middle East, again, it is that yearning, which is so much a part of Rumi and Hafez and the Arab mystics. And we want to excavate, you know, to find, to track everything back to its originating impulse, you know, and set it free again. So, yeah, so the yearning, you know, yearning, I think, really is a way of turning grief into kinship and action. Yeah. It's an embrace that we're all in this dream together. So the yearning, and then I did say I wanted to bring in the chart of the astro mythology of now and the birth of Islam and your own chart, because they're beautifully fused. So my wonderful friend Sylvia Hanley, there can be many charts, you know, but she created the birth of Islam as June 19th, 622 AD, 6:44 p.m., you know, Muhammad rides into Medina at sunset. And we go, ooh, it's a workable chart, because just for the fun of it, today, as a theme throughout this year, Uranus, which is nature's liberating trickster principle, is in Taurus, you know, earth-based animistic sensuality. I'll say it and translate it at 4 degrees of Taurus. So it's exactly trining the Mars-Neptune-Moon-Uranus conjunction in the birth of Islam chart in Virgo, meaning that feminine mystical yearning is there and it wants to come alive now. It's eager for that. And then just for the fun of it, in your own beautiful chart, Neptune dreams and vision for the first time in 165 years is trining your son in Cancer, keeper of history. And so it does say to you, and this is part of our dynamic, it says, imagine that the deepest, most souled part of you and what you care most about is about to be completely welcome. And since we're all in this dream together, let's, you know, everybody kind of feel that. So this liberating, and this is a mystery of the Middle East, which you are uniquely, educated to address. Because, so growing up, I loved Middle Eastern music and culture and dance and the call to prayer for no environmentally supported reason at all. And reading the Arabian Nights, you know, which is full of women redeemers, right? Because Scheherazade means city redeemer and her sister Dunyazade means world redeemer. And and I go, it had to have been okay for women at some point, right? You know, and then maybe you can also remind us of, you know, the prophet's wife. And she was a businesswoman running an import-export business. He was an employee, right?
She was 20 years older, and she picked this young man and said, "He's, you know, he became her husband." I mean, she was 20 years older than him, and as you said, you know, she sent him out. That's where he went to Ethiopia. We know that he may have gone up to as far as Petra, but he absolutely was. This was a very modern partnership. And, you know, it's amazing that you've tapped on this feminine dimension of Islam, because I have three examples I wanted to share with you and the listeners to just imagine what is happening. The Sudanese have just overthrown a butcher named Bashir, who ran their country for 30 years. He's the one who gave them the Darfur crisis and slaughtered so many in Western Sudan. Well, the entire coup d'etat, the whole revolution against Bashir that made him step down, was run primarily by Sudanese women, young activists who stood on top of cars calling out to their brothers and sisters. And there was a certain moment where they literally marched in front of parliament when they heard that the Saudis and the Emirates were going to offer the new junta some money, 3 I don't know, they said something like $10 million or $100 million. And they all chanted, we would rather starve with dignity than take that filthy money from these people. We know what they will do to us. They've already done it to us. We don't want it. Right. Now, you look at the Kurdish women. The Kurds in eastern Syria that rose up were the ones actually who really struck the fear of God in the hearts of all these ISIS misogynists. And what happened, ironically, is the ISIS misogynist fighters were defeated by young women who came from their Kurdish villages, who signed up to fight in these militias. And with a larger group called the YPG, they fought town by town. And it turns out that the young women were the best snipers. And when they were in the front lines, the ISIS fighters would run for their lives. Why? Because as these young men viewed women as lesser, as dirty, as soiled, a bullet coming from their gun would prevent them from entering paradise. So when the young ladies were in the front lines, they actually would break and run so that they would not be, abjectly kept from paradise that was awaiting. And if you see the faces of these young women, it's just so heart-rending because they are the people who fought on the ground. I mentioned this last time, but we have to remember it. If any of your listeners just go and look Kurdish women Syria on Google, you will see images that will just break your heart. And these are the people that should be celebrated and protected also because you know what they've done. Caroline, every position in the newly established territory run by these by the Kurdish group called the YPG have in the positions of mayor, in the positions of the head of the school, both women and men serving concurrently. Now, that doesn't happen outside of Scandinavia. And the final character I wanted to mention is a woman named Ani Zonneveld that I think you and your listeners would love to hear from, a Malay American who is who founded Muslims for Progressive Values. And look at what she has done. They say that the adhan or the prayer that you love so much, that sound and the, you know, the call to prayer, it can be led by a woman or a man. That individual men and women can choose to stand or sit on one side or the other if they prefer. And in fact, she will provide through various followers services, wedding services, matrimonial services for same-sex and for interfaith couples. This has never happened before. And you have, what is her argument? Her argument is, at one stage, the prophet reached out into his community and called for a woman to lead the prayers. And that woman's name, and she gives the name, she said, if my prophet could have chosen a woman to lead the prayers, who am I to say that I cannot lead the prayers? And so this Muslim for Progressive Values is a totally new approach that's being run out with Annie and all her associates, and they have different prayer groups across the country that meet, and there's complete equality, gender equality, and again, they fight to address all the misogynist interpretations of Islamic scripture and tradition that lead to these human rights abuses against women in the name of Islam, which are not there. They're invented, and they're continually reasserted. But anyway, these were three examples I wanted to share because there is movement, an exciting movement. We just need to know about it.
No, there's so much in what you say. I was scribbling notes to go, I'll come back to that. That's really great. Yeah, so George Bernard Shaw, you know, may he be praised as an ancestor. Yeah, he said for women to have the vote, not enough. For every position, there should be a man and woman, right? So you go, all right, the Kurdish women. And then I was amazed and delighted. Everything comes together, these syncretizing, we all need each other, the best of the liberating traditions, that the Kurdish women had been inspired by the writings of Murray Bookchin, right?
And absolutely.
Right, and Murray Bookchin is, I from my early anarchist youth, where I read everything, thanks to Tonya Aminoff and Kenneth Baker, they said I gave them spirituality, they gave me anarchism. And so we read all the texts, you know, but including Murray Bookchin, who is, again, the intrinsic, we throw out the toxic, you know, rebranding of anarchy, because it really is the most spiritual form of governance, because it says if everybody really is tapped in to their heart and their dynamic, there will be community accord, right? Yes. And the community is the leader. So there's Murray Bookchin. That's really great. Yes, Muslims for Progressive Values. Absolutely. Let's all kahoot. That's wonderful. I like quipping also, right? Because I remember reading that, yes, the ISIS fighters were terrified if they were killed by a woman, they would not go to paradise, which is a great catch 22. But I also like saying, no, it's not 1,000 virgins, it's 1,000 angry vegans who are going to just. So we want to, in the spirit of Sufi trickster shapeshifting, we want that. And then, you know, and excavating all that's beautiful and liberating that's been covered up. So there's an amazing piece, you know, reading in Jeremy Corbyn and so on. In the Quran, there's an amazing place. It says that you meet the guide, the green man, Qadir. I'm not going to pronounce Qadir completely right, where oceans converge. And I was reading this in Turkey. I go, I'm where oceans converge. And they say that's where Moses meets Qadir. And Qadir basically says to him, what is this fixation you have on rules? Right. Yes. What is this commandment rule thing?
Exactly.
And he basically gives him Shaktipat, and he goes, let me liberate you into direct thing. It's and I told that to Persian women I was traveling with, and they were like, that's in the Quran. And I go, yeah, it is in there. You got to dig for these things. But this is the time, and then the mystery of you know, where things go underground and emerge through aesthetics, and then to be liberated into governance. But that's also part of, as you know so well, the beauty of Arab culture. It's that curvy arabesque, the yearning of the music and the architecture that is so exquisite, like, it's very feminine, you know, the curviness. Feminine within us all, regardless of our temporary age, race, and gender assignment. It's like, and the music, really, again, I think for all of us, we throw everything into the cauldron, all teachings, all everything. Really, it's a Sufic, Aikido, trickster time, everything into the cauldron. It only does it good. And go, is it equal men and women? Is it equal humans and the rest of our kin on this earth?
Yes.
Does it guide people to their own autonomy? Yes, we ladle it out. No, we throw it back in for another round of bubbling, as, you know, again, the wonderful chickpea poem translated by Coleman. Do you remember that offhand, the chickpea poem?
Yeah, well, I don't have it with me, but yes, I remember it well.
I don't have the exact text, but I think that's very apt now. We're all getting cooked. It's again the divine cook is stirring the cauldron, and the chickpea tries to leap out, right? And he goes, no, back you go, because you are being cooked with spices to be something of the divine. And we go, well, we're all being cooked now. And that's part of the kind of strategy of the Birth of Islam chart, which is this beautiful, authentic, backstage originating impulse of true equality and liberation and exquisite knowledge and refinement and art and beauty and prayer and whatever is coming alive. And at the same time, Pluto squaring Pluto, it's neck and neck, right? Beauty and cruelty everywhere in the world.
Right.
So we're betting on beauty, right?
We're betting on beauty, and we know that there are those anchors and those poets and that writing and that inspiration, as you said, that has always had to flourish and then go underground and flourish again and then go underground. This is the cycle of history time and time again. When insecurity and fear run rampant, like we see in our time today, as often as these leaders are trying to use almost like a whack-a-mole, as often they're trying to pound down those who would be free thinkers and free to express their love of the divine and not to be bound by the laws, as you said, the Mosaic laws, but rather to be fueled by the fire of Hermes, the famous figure in mystical thought, Hermes Trismegistus. There was the anchor of all alchemists. There was the anchor of all the hermetic studies that were part of the esoteric spirit in the European tradition. But believe it or not, they also were in the Islamic world. And Hermes was also recuperated, like he was here in Florence, where I live. He was recuperated here through the Medicis. And that is what gives Botticelli the ability to syncretically go back and paint Venus. And he will say, but she is the Madonna, just in different form. She's syncretically all of these, Mother Earth, the Mother Goddess, is both the Madonna, she becomes Aphrodite, she becomes Venus, she becomes Isis, the goddess of the Nile. I mean, all of this is happening during the Renaissance. And it also was happening concurrently in the Islamic world, with people, the great Sufi mystic Sohrawardi, who was called the guide or the master of illumination, where he spoke about Ishraq, this illumination that sometimes we meet people and we just see their eyes glowing. And in that glow, there's an otherworldliness. And they may be spiritually touched. It may be something that they've carried all their lives. Whatever it is, that Ishraq is a word that is absolutely central as a description. And so how does one seek that illumination, and how do we protect those who emanate and use that in the world, whether it's, as you talked about, Coleman Barks or someone like yourself who is spreading light in this very dark, almost Caravaggesque moment where there's so much shadow, and yet there are those rays of light. I think the lesson in what we've seen with the Wahhabis is theirs is a doomed game to try and control Islam. Theirs is a doomed and a failure that is already prescribed. Even in the Quran and in the Hadith, there are descriptions of men with big beards and black cloaks that claim to represent God, that don't smile, that come with swords. But they have no place in anyone's future. It's so clear. And so, in a way, we're all being tested. The Islamic world's being tested. We are being tested. Can we see through this mad attempt to try and demonize 1.5 billion people and realize it's just a handful of Wahhabis who have this mad anger and violent burning within. It's a handful. They have no representation within the Islamic community or the Islamic world. And as much as they're renegades, we had our own renegades in places like Mississippi and Louisiana that used to hang African Americans just to, again, to create that fear, just to darken the days ahead. There is no place in the long scheme of history. Theirs is a doomed battle. So you carry the light. You carry the light.
Well, we all. But again, all that you say is fabulously resonant, because as we began conversing for this show, here we are. What was rising in the East? 28 plus Virgo. There are metaphors for each degree of the zodiac. And its metaphor was, in a cave overhung with twisted roots, a seeker pours over the glowing pages of an illuminated alchemical manuscript. And we go, yes, all right, we want to bring it all, you know, back alive. I've told this story often, but I keep it in my heart forever. And you haven't heard it. So when I was in Aleppo, again, when it was still okay, and as we drove in, my friend Deborah, this was years ago, said, you know, it's still here, as though she knew. It's still here, you know, protect it. We went to the oldest souk in Aleppo, where you can always get lost, and it was fantastic. And I found an Aladdin's lamp and other fabulous things. And there was great wit and humor and irony with all of the people. It was really great. And then we went to the calligrapher, the Islamic calligrapher, who was bearded fundamentalists scowling, not happy to see three Western women, even though one spoke beautiful Arabic. Then, here's the you never know, my friend introduced me to him as an astrologer, and he bowed in respect. And I was like, what? I said, what is this, the scowling, bearded fundamentalist guy? And she goes, well, that's because it means something here. I was like, wow. But then he did this beautiful thing, because we're okay now in some you never know trickster thing. He wrote with vegetable ink. He took beautiful magic healing words from the Quran. He wrote them with vegetable ink on rice paper, and then he put it in our tea so we could drink the words.
Oh, fantastic.
And I go, I love that, because all beauty, magic, the whole world is literalized metaphor. I mean, we live in this intrinsically symbolic realm. And that means also that, you know, for all of us and for the beauty of Islam and the whole Middle Eastern and Persian and Turkish culture, you know, the power of metaphor and yearning, the true call to prayer, to awaken, it really wants to happen now. And then my late ally, well known in the Bay Area, Jay Arnall, great ancestor, but he said years ago, he said, if you Google a picture of the Kaaba, the stone, right, where everyone kisses, he says that there, where everyone kisses, there's a silver inlaid yoni. It was put there to keep the integrity of the stone together, but it's definitely a yoni. And he said, once again, it's men worshiping mom and calling it dad. Anyway, so there are these heresies, which we are free to say, right? There's no there's no fatwa coming at us. So that's why we want to open it up for those who can't, and honor the intrinsic beauty and liberating quality. And then here's something, just because we're backstage, we're all really invited to tease into practical application the beautiful, the beauty that we love, you know, going out. That's why I love the syncretism of going Sufi Aikido, meaning not a swirling, a triumphant, not martyrs, because it was Murray Bookchin who wrote about, you know, after the Russian Revolution, Nestor Makhno in the Ukraine was an anarchist community that was going very well, and they were the thriving community in Russia because they didn't kill everybody. They said, this is our experiment, oh, doctors and educated people. You can join if you want or not. You know, so they had doctors in an educated class, and it was Trotsky who said, you know, turn over your army, the best army. And they go, no. And he said, well, come for a meeting. And they did, and Trotsky killed them all. Right. So it's like, no, a little more Aikido. A little more Aikido. A little more wary, spicy, trickster competence, you know, into this mix that we wanna create. So well, and then let me toss it back to you, because everywhere, you know, it's like where there is uninitiated Mars, you know, hyper yang death frenzy, which is really arrested development around the age of 14, right?
Yes.
These guys are raised without women, without mothers, without whatever, without any feminine, and it's like the sociopathic 14-year-old rampage with no Venus. So what you're doing, what we love, you know, where there'd be uninitiated Mars, hyper-yang death frenzy, then we turn to the Venus, to the beauty, to the culture, to the nature of that place, you know, in Palestine, in the Sudan, in you know. And so I've always wanted that there be a huge festival in the Middle East run by Middle Eastern and Persian women for 1,001 nights, and which everyone gets to tell their story, right? Because it's for lack of story. I remember hearing this Palestinian man saying, you know, they mowed down my grandfather and great-grandfather's olive trees. This is a crime, and no one will listen to me. I will blow myself up. Right. And we go, yes, before you do that, tell us your story. Tell us your story.
You know, let's hear it.
Right. Yes. I mean, again, that willingness and curiosity. So that's, you know, we just want to put desirable animations on the altar of desirable mystery, going, that would be good. So you're very in touch with the beauty, right? And you live in Florence, which has many beautiful Middle Eastern architectural and a beautiful imam. Say more about the Italian Middle Eastern confluence.
Well, it's strange because, you know, I was just explaining to an Indonesian friend who came here today, and I was helping him understand how Florence is the only city in the Western Christianity that is completely dedicated to the Madonna, which is to say to the Mother Earth, which is to say all of those figures, whether it be Venus, Aphrodite, whether it be Isis, whatever configuration you want to use, she is represented here. And with that in mind, she is standing against all the patriarchal Goliath of Rome, right? The David is the symbol of a young upstart who is going to be mad enough to take on the great giant, which is Rome. And she does. But she does it not by going out with crusades and trying to, again, wrap the arms around Mars and the 14-year-old violent frenzy. No, with the understanding that the whole Mediterranean is a lake, that on the other side of the Mediterranean are brothers and sisters that can be spoken to, that have both commerce, they have the luxury goods, the silks, they have the carpets, they have pepper, they have the spices, they have the mask that you saw in Damascus, which is where the word Damascus comes from.
Oh, wait, and where does it come from again?
Damask, the famous Damask silk is from Damascus, right?
Yes.
So what do they want to do? They want to trade. But here's the point, Caroline. It doesn't stop with just trading for pepper, trading silver for pepper, or trading silver or gold for the silk coming out of Beirut or out of Damascus. It is also the ideas that they bring back. It's the syncretic ideas that they bring into Florence that work their way into the story so that all of a sudden this city does not celebrate just the father and the son. But what is it? It's always the mother in the garden of the paradise, the Garden of Eden. In this mythic garden, what is she always sitting on? A Persian carpet. Mm. She's another world. And this is a city that understands that her destiny is with the Levantine world, with the East, that she is tied up. Our success is their success and vice versa. Instead of launching out in the insane wars that we see coming from Rome, inspired by the Vatican and French freebooters and mercenaries, instead, she is interested in trade back and forth. And that is how all of the great manuscripts from the Greek world arrive here, because they've been translated into Arabic and then into Greek and into the Latin. And what does this culture here do? Download all of that world so that they can differentiate themselves from Goliath to the south. And by doing that, who do they identify with? Not just ancient Egyptians and Hermes and the Greek world and the Roman world, but the Medicis. I don't know if you're aware of this, the Medicis had as their great day was the famous procession of the Magi, which is Epiphany, the 6th of January. Why is that?
Yeah.
This is when all the East comes and bears witness of this child that's been born, and they are Zoroastrian Magi, Zoroastrian astronomer priests, back to your astrology.
Astrologers, really, yes, exactly.
And they've come to recognize this child. So somehow in the identity of Florence, all of this links with the geometry of the carpets and also of the mosques are brought and adorn all of the churches here. The idea of the Great Mother being resurrected and this city identifying for it. The feminine beauty that is worshipped here in this city that really comes alive. There are no aristocrats. They have been banned for 200 years. And that's when the city flourishes, because every person has to be part of the guild. They have to be working. And the young members of the family are all educated, young women and young men. Why? Because if we're going to do our merchant work in the world, our young ladies are also going to be running the business. So this is the first place with universities, the first public library, and a glorious orphanage that's built by Brunelleschi for the most vulnerable. We protect our most vulnerable. That is our solidarity in the link. So there's so much of humanism that's wrapped up in this broader intercultural vision that you were talking about.
And then underneath humanism, the even greater beauty of animism. Everything's alive, and we go, that's beautiful. And then you also love your Florentine imam, and maybe, again, refer to him again as you did last week, but as one of the... We want to put standards, as you do in your book, The Wahhabi Code, so beautifully, vetting standards for criterion, for sane reverence, for imams, for the welcome crossing of borders. And so you say that your Florentine imam embodies that.
He really embodies it, and also because, you know, he identifies himself as a Florentine, not as a Saudi trained imam who has been sent here to indoctrinate. Instead, he's from Italy. He speaks Italian beautifully. He's a man of great culture, and he understands his great fortune of living here. He honors it, and he also honors his community. And before he was doing that, he was a private citizen, and he had his own private enterprise. In other words, all of the obsession that we think is part of Muslim tradition, that every imam has to come from Saudi Arabia, is a complete fallacy. On the contrary, this has never happened before. And it's the mere sending of imams educated in Saudi Arabia that has spread all of this, as you say, the toxic tyranny. It spread toxic tyranny within the Muslim world. And many Muslims will tell you they don't want to see these imams enter into their mosques because they change the conversation. They raise up Mars and they destroy Venus.
Right.
That's what is needed. But money talks. Now, where do we come in? As people of concerned brothers and sisters, we can help them have the courage to stand up and say no, to help them have the courage to raise their voices, to let them understand that they aren't alone, and that we also understand the kind of pains they're going through. This is so important. And like we were saying, if there isn't a church, synagogue, temple in Saudi Arabia, should we be allowing their funds to pour in this very intolerant deviation of Islam into our worlds? Maybe the argument should be no. Until you show us this tolerance, we do not. We just don't feel that we need to abide. It's a sign of respect. But also in doing that, you end up protecting the very Islamic communities that are within the country, trying to keep free of this toxic tyranny.
So in the spirit of radio magic, there's Trump and his really kinky relationship to the Saudis, and Jared Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman's kinky relationship to Ivanka. It's like, wow, it's all very kinky, you know. And the smuggling of information, the death of Khashoggi, which Jared Kushner might have contributed to by saying, here are your enemies. The nefarious wanting to give Saudi nuclear technology. We go, no, may this be awakening. May Trickster come in. May this be dissolved and prevented. May it, you know, spiral forth. And and just because these are such important themes everywhere, I'm pretty sure that my great ally in the past, Marsilio Ficino, great Renaissance astrologer, I think he was in Florence.
He was an astrologer to the Medicis, and he's the one who translates all of Plato.
So when I found him, I found a kindred spirit, because he was always berating the astrologers of Florence for creating a superstitious priesthood. And he goes, that's not what this liberating language is for. So you may not, you know, may I buy real estate? Yes, you may not. He goes, no. This is about autonomy and again in a Sufic kind of way, you know, and the power of beauty and talismanic magic and stuff to alleviate things. But there is no fixed fate, right? So he was very, very authentic, right? And I just want to bring it back because, you know, anything can become tyrannical once you get a priesthood, right?
Yeah. I
think that a lot of what happened, like, the Ten Commandments were basically stolen from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which it's 101 professions. I have not stolen. I have not. And it gets turned into commandments. And I think, you know, the thou shalt not give an image of the divine. I think before that was a commandment, it was just an observation. that you can't, you know, it's like you can go Hindu, which is 10 million monkey gods, or vast mystery nothingness, you know, and which it would be imposition. But I think these were all perceptions that then some priesthood turned into a command, and then you get tyranny, and then you get here we are.
Yes. No, I totally agree with you. And that's why look at these words of Ibn Arabi, what he says here. My heart has become capable of every form. It's a pasture for gazelles, a monastery for Christian monks, a temple for idols, and the pilgrim's Kaaba, and the tablets of the Torah and the book of the Quran. I follow the religion of love. Wherever way that love's camel take, that is my religion and my faith. So against that tyranny of the clergy, in whatever form, these are the voices that break free. And they break free with such courage that actually they speak to us today. It's you read those words and they're so radically powerful. I mean, look, he says, you know, my heart's become capable of every form, a temple for idols. I mean, this is why the Wahhabis are going around killing Muslims across the Islamic world, because they claim they're worshiping idols. And he says next to it, the pilgrim's Kaaba. I mean, this is why the reading some of this poetry also empowers us, because what we're finding is courage in its most striking form. I mean, the mere heresies that are uttered in that one sentence would end somebody's life, not only in today, but 400 years ago. And that is the courage of the tricksters to speak out, for us to be aware, to look at these worlds, look at these words of Sa'di, who says, children of Adam are all members of the same body, who in creation were made of the same essence. Again, this whole hermetic idea. If one part is wounded, the whole body suffers. He or she who does not feel others' pain cannot call himself a son or a daughter of man. And these are inscribed in the United Nations.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. This is these words of Sa'di have been often cited at the United Nations, and again, liberating words that help us go beyond the fear, go beyond this treacherous patriarchal tyranny that allows for that compassion to come in and be voiced. Sometimes if you read the poetry aloud, it's safer than if you say it in your own words.
Right,
because you're one's quoting from tradition. I mean, in 1,000 years, next year, Omar Khayyam will have his 1,000th anniversary. And I just had the governor of Nishapur visiting Florence here, and he is going to have a celebration. Mm. Now, the clerics don't like Khayyam because he speaks about drinking from the glass. But actually, if you look at Sufi language, that glass can also be your own vessel. If you're intoxicated, it may just be your, back to Ficino, the love of God, the love of the divine that's inside you. And that's how many of these Sufi poets were able to defend themselves. I wasn't talking about wine exactly. I was talking about the intoxication I have, just like you have, Caroline, when you start riffing on all of this affection that you have and how you've been moved by these different traditions and syncretic messages. Well, that is precisely the divine love that Ficino was talking about, amore divino. So, Is our friend going ahead? Yes, he's going to have that 1,000-year celebration.
Wonderful.
And so we have to, you know, allow those beams of light to come pouring in.
Right. No, and yeah, and I love also that a great ally of all of ours, Jarvis Masters. I will be in touch pretty soon, Jarvis, who lives on death row in San Quentin, but and is a wonderful, beautiful man, and has written, you know, Finding Freedom, Writings from Death Row, and many beautiful things. But he sent me years ago, and again, we keep these things always in our heart, our inner counsel, a card with a Rumi quote, or alleged Rumi quote, we don't know, but it was striking. It said, "Whoever finds love underneath disappointment and grief disappears into 1,000 new ecstatic disguises."
Right.
And I love that, right? Because we think of disguise maybe as a prison, not a freedom. And we say about everything, it can be a prison or a freedom. You know, categories can be beacons of light that guide us or imprisoning prisons. And that's our dedication, you know, about everything. I mean, every discipline can be a freedom or a tyranny, right? And that's, it's again neck and neck now. But yeah, the Omar Khayyam, that's so great. And also very grateful to your book, Wahhabi Code. I think everyone should read it, especially Americans, because we know so little about, because it takes complexity and the capacity to hold multiple contradictory stories at once to even wend one's way through the Middle East. But what I love about, you know, like from South Africa, the medicine that comes from, there are people who have every reason to be bitter and who are, right? But there are people who have every reason to be bitter and who aren't. And it's like, that's amazing. And I love irony. And I love the irony that is so much a part of the Middle Eastern character, which is the ally in a glance, the wink, the you see that too. You know, if we're seeing the horrible thing together, we can liberate and make it funny.
Exactly.
If we have that connection, I love that so much. So anyway, so you also have, again, Hafez and the connection between Ralph Waldo Emerson and Goethe and Hafez, which is also apparently, you know, Emerson and Thoreau read the Upanishads and Gandhi read Emerson and Thoreau, which is how he found out about the Upanishads on his own. So it's a wonderful thing. So I don't know if you remember this particular Hafez, "Let Us Be Crowned with Roses."
Yes.
Shall I read it, or do you have it?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But again, the truly liberating and radical quality, Hafez says, "Let us be crowned with roses, and let us drink wine and break up the tiresome old roof of heaven into new forms." That's so now, eternal, liberating. Exactly. You know, the divine wants to be liberated from past confines of human imagination. And that's the beauty of Islam, going, you cannot fixate on one image, but as a wisdom, not a, you know, not a rule, for God's sake, or for God, any of that. So that's fabulous. And you do honor, you know, how truly, heretic means free thinker. It was a welcome aspect of Christianity. You know, until there was a priesthood, then it would get you killed. And so we welcome heresy, right? Do we not?
Yes. And you know, again, you know, when you cite that, that I wrote in the book, I didn't try and write this to just speak only about the Saudi Wahhabi experience. I really wanted to try and show that other faces of Islam, this great constellation, that has so many different aspects, interpretations, from the Ismailis to the Sunni world, to the Sufi world, and all the tariqas. It's the whole Shia Islam tradition. It's impossible that we're still in this day and age using the word Islam to describe 1.5 billion people with a multiplicity of different interpretations, each that I would argue, of course, is welcome under the same Godhead, under the same divine. How could it not be?
Right.
And this is the kind of the mental trap that we find ourselves being caught in by the masters of war and the marketers of bombing and explosives and tank machinery and all of that defense industry. You know, after the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, there was a desperate search for a new enemy, and it's been created. We just have to understand that this is all a mechanistic.
Right. So but that's really important because we want to throw into the cauldron our species' addiction to having an enemy. And again, here comes the spiral dance, which is so beautiful. And then the last thing I want to toss back to you as we skedaddle. Which is I heard E.O. Wilson speak at the cathedral here in D.C. years ago, and he's working with fundamentalist Christians, and he goes, we disagree about a lot, but we have a common desire to steward the earth, right? And we can disagree as a luxury in the future, but this wedding of science and religion, because it's going to need a religious fervor to catalyze a global dynamic. And in our last 30 seconds, I want to toss it to you, because I think that what you love so much and liberated Islam, Sufism, Sufi Aikido, has that sense of we're all in this dream, let's do this, we can do it, right?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. And each of us has our individual path of coming to the awareness that we can have the courage, the singular courage, to be part of a larger effort, to be part of a larger, shall we say, thought waves that are even in the darkest moments, embracing that positivity, embracing this collectiveness, embracing this gender equality, actually doing away with all the dualism imaginable.
And the wolf tone says we have come to the end of our cahooting at the moment, but it's also, there was a wonderful woman, Gunelli Gunn, stop that wolf tone. There we go. Who said, you know, underneath everything, the original deity in the Middle East was wolf. Was a wolf woman being that I think it became Scheherazade, and we go right. This celebration of all of that. So thank you so much, Terrence Ward, whose wonderful book, The Wahhabi Code. I want everybody to read and give copies and put in libraries and all of that, just to begin this conversing that is so crucial and beautiful. And I honor the complexity of your own cultivated self, because I've seen you give your talk to, you know, political beings, you know, and then to the Sufic world, and here we are. So let's keep this going.
Lovely. Listen, Christine, any time, Caroline, you just let me know, and I will never forget that description of the drinking the words in the bazaar.
Let's do that. Literalized metaphor is the essence of ritual magic, and thank you all, KPFA team, and we will be returned next week. Woof, 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 woof.